Climate scientists around the world have been issuing a steady drumbeat of warnings and data pointing to profound changes and shifts that have already begun because of climate change. Yet a UK survey finds when it comes to climate denial, the United States leads the world. Only 54% of Americans agree that human activity is largely causing the climate change we're currently seeing. Why is the U.S. the world leader in climate denial? And how can scientists and policymakers convert the deniers? Henry Pollack is an emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan. He shares the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore for his work with the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Welcome back to Stateside, Professor Pollack.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And we're joined by Edward Maybach. He's a professor and he's director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Edward, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Henry, I want to start with you. Did it surprise you to see that figure that here we are, United States, number one in the world in climate denial?
No, that's not a surprise. I've been aware of that trend now for more than two decades, and it's a reality. There are a lot of complex reasons for it, but nevertheless, we are the leader.
And Edward, when I see that the percentage at one time was all the way up to 72% in the early 2000s, why the slide backward?
It's a complicated situation, but it basically comes down to one word, politics. Some of our political leaders have decided this is something they don't want to deal with, and the way they have chosen to do so is by denying its reality. And a lot of Americans take their cues from our political leaders.
Then I also noticed that numbers 2 and 3 in climate denial, respectively, were Great Britain and Australia, while at the other end, 93% of the people in China agreed that human activity is causing this. Why is climate denial so strong in English-speaking countries, do you think, Henry?
Well, I think it has to do with the political systems, and the English-speaking world has much in common in their political systems. I think that the debates that go on and the awareness of the debates that the body politic, you know, has does make this a much more volatile, opinionated environment.
What do you think, Edward?
Yeah, we're strong believers here in the United States in the free market system. And unfortunately, climate change has been misconstrued, I believe, as a threat to free market ideology. And that really is the driver why, I mean, you can roll back the clock for about 15 years until the late 90s, and Democrats and Republicans pretty much saw the issue in the same way. About 2 out of 3 of both groups were convinced that climate change was real and seemed serious. In the intervening years, Democrats, almost all of them have become convinced of the reality of climate change, and most of them feel it's quite serious. And unfortunately, Republicans have sort of moved in the other direction. So now we're down to about a third or 40% of Republicans who see climate change as real. So we've got the conflation of the problem with the solution in the minds of Republicans. And fortunately, I think there is an opportunity going forward to deconflate those two ideas. You know, let's dismiss the scientific reality of the situation we're facing, but let's bring the best free market solutions forward and put them on the table and let's have a real conversation about them.
But then, meantime, taking it out of the policymaking level and getting very, very granular, and this is purely anecdotal, but I am thinking of someone I know, have known for a long time, and inevitably, when the subject of climate change and global warming would come up, there would be a sneer from him, and then he would turn that immediately into a sneer at Vice President Gore and then at President Obama. So there we've got people in the homes of America doing that.
I think that you've made a very important point there. A lot of our acceptance of message depends on who the messenger is. And you've pointed out that Vice President Gore has detractors. He also has a large band of followers. I can give you another example of this messenger effect. An earlier environmental issue, the creation of the ozone hole over the Antarctic, took place during President Reagan's presidency, and his vice president was George H.W. Bush. When the issue of the scientific understanding of it and the cause of it became clear, the U.S. did not back away from it. And the question was why. And one insight that has been called to my attention is that President Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, were very good friends and influenced each other greatly. Well, Margaret Thatcher was an industrial chemist before she was the Prime Minister. And when the scientific evidence was presented to her, she said, oh, of course, we've got to do something about it. And Ronald Reagan said, you know, Maggie, if you say we have to do something about it, we should. And the USA marched ahead on that, and we had an international treaty, the Montreal Protocol, that went into effect. And that issue now is largely in remediation.
But we don't see this country marching ahead in unison with much of anything, do we, Edward?
No, we don't. Unfortunately, Capitol Hill's fairly gridlocked on pretty much all issues that face us at the moment. Certainly, this issue is front and center in terms of gridlock. But, Cynthia, I'd actually like to introduce another point, which is, you know, while the U.S. may lead the world in terms of the proportion of our citizens who don't yet understand that climate change is a real problem, 64% of the public does understand that climate change is real versus 19% who don't yet understand. So I just want to make it really clear that the majority of Americans really are at a state where they accept the fact that there is a problem to be dealt with. Unfortunately, in the public dialogue right now is so often about the wrong question. The question of is it happening or isn't it? Is it human caused or isn't it? The useful dialogue would be, what do we want to do about it? And that the really interesting thing we find in our polling data, there is a larger proportion of Americans who would actually like to see our elected officials move forward and start making decisions about how to deal with climate change than there are citizens who are convinced that human caused climate change is occurring. Meaning, there are plenty of people out there who still aren't yet sure about climate change, but if it is real, it sounds bad to them, and they just assume that our leaders do what we pay them to do, which is lead.
I'll come back to the messenger issue here. And just recently, there was a plan of action put out by Michael Bloomberg and Henry Paulson, the former Secretary of the Treasury under President Bush, and they had this plan called, or it's titled, Risky Business. And it says, as you know, business people, we have to assess risk. And so let's look at climate change, see what the risk is. How can we plan for the risk? And both of those people, Bloomberg and Paulson, are Republicans. And so, again, there's an attempt to have the messenger have the credibility with the people who are facing these issues.
I'm talking with Henry Pollack, who's an emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, also sharing the Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore for his work in climate change, and also talking with Edward Maybach, who's a professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. I saw a term as I was kind of researching our conversation today. Climate optimists, as in, oh, yeah, it's real, but it's nothing to worry about. Edward, where did that come from, and who's buying into that?
I actually haven't heard that term before, but I see people in our surveys that do comport with that idea, that yes, it's real, but I'm not terribly worried about it. We see that over half of Americans are worried about climate change, but only 15% would characterize themselves as very worried about climate change. Conversely, when I speak to my climate science colleagues, most of them strike me as pretty darn worried that we are creating changes in the climate that human civilization arose in, changes that are going to be really quite challenging for human civilization to continue to thrive in. So I, as a social scientist working on the issue of climate change, I see a fairly profound disconnect between the level of worry that I see among average Americans and the level of worry I see among my climate science colleagues.
That's absolutely right. Scientists look at the observations of the natural world, and they see big changes taking place now. I think a lot of the disconnect for people who seem disengaged or not worried is that they think the consequences are all long in the future. And in fact, the consequences are happening right now. We're seeing climate change globally, but everything that we call global climate change is expressed locally. It reminds me of Tip O'Neill's old statement that all politics are local. Ultimately, all climate change is local, too. And people have to see the changes are happening in their environment for them really to get engaged with it and recognize that it's a problem right now, right at home.
Edward, does your data find that the message is not being delivered in the right way to make it believable to the public?
Yes, in a word, yes. But let me give you a little bit of context behind that. What we find is that the average American thinks there's a lot of disagreement among the experts about whether or not human-caused climate change is happening. In reality, there's an overwhelming agreement among the experts, a scientific consensus among the experts that human-caused climate change is occurring. So this most fundamental of ideas or of facts has been misconstrued or misunderstood by many members of the public. And that's not an accident. There's been a very aggressive misinformation campaign to suggest that there is disagreement among the experts, when in fact no such disagreement exists. Our research has shown that members of the public who believe that there is a lot of disagreement among the experts are less likely to be personally convinced that climate change is real, is human-caused, is a serious threat to people, to human beings, and is solvable. So the misinformation campaign, mischaracterizing the scientific consensus, has unfortunately been all too effective. So that's on one side of the issue. On the other side of the issue, I don't actually see a systematic effort to educate the American people about the realities of climate change, as Dr. Pollack was suggesting, about the fact that it's happening here and now. It is, in fact, a threat for our future, but it's also currently manifesting in every region of the country. And there isn't really a systematic effort to share with the American people what we know about climate change, which is really curious to me, considering I spent the first 25 years of my career working in the field of public health. And in public health, we spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a fair amount of money educating the public about the threats, the proven, the known threats to the public's health and well-being, like tobacco and seatbelt use and substance abuse prevention and this sort of thing, whereas we don't yet see that kind of sustained, concerted effort to educate the public about the risks of climate change.
Why is that, Henry?
I can't say for sure, but one of the things that Professor Maybach has written about is somewhat of a disconnect between the weatherman on TV and the story of climate change. The public, of course, much of their science comes from the local meteorologist. I think there's a general misunderstanding about the role of meteorologists and the role of climatologists. It's kind of like the two blind people examining the elephant, and each is seeing a different story. The meteorologists focus on the here and now, you know, the immediate aspects of our natural environment, what's happening today, tomorrow, and next week. Whereas the climatologist is looking at the long-term view. It reminds me a little bit of a Wall Street analogy between day traders and someone who manages a retirement portfolio. The retirement portfolio manager has a 30 or 40-year perspective, and the day trader doesn't have a 30-minute perspective sometimes. So each has their role, but if I was interested in long-term climate change, I wouldn't be consulting a day trader for the best advice and insight.
What about behavior of the human brain? When you think of just what we're being bombarded with, we civilians, whether it's news stories about immigration challenges to poverty to bloodshed in the Middle East to all of these problems, is it understandable where people's brains just are too saturated to accept that climate change is here and now? It doesn't seem immediate. It's easy to put it on the back burner and let somebody down the road in history worry about it.
Right. Professor Danny Kahneman from Princeton wrote a fabulous book called Thinking Fast and Slow, and I hope lots of your listeners have read it or will read it, because it's a really fabulous accounting of the fact that every one of us has two different information processing systems in our brain. One of those systems is highly attuned to analytical learning, learning through numbers, learning through analysis, and that's how we have learned about climate change. But the other information processing system that is in every one of our brains is what is called an experiential learning system. It's how we learn through our day-to-day experiences. And Professor Kahneman calls the one experiential learning system one, and the other analytical learning system two. System one pretty much consistently trumps system two. In other words, what we learn from our day-to-day experience becomes much more vivid, much more compelling to us, and ultimately shapes our worldview more strongly than does anything that we're privy to through analytical learning.
It sounds like what I'm hearing you both say is we do need to try to seize on those teachable moments. Detroit's coping with a 5 to 6 inch rainfall that's got 14 foot standing water floods under freeways because of the extreme weather event. So you're saying taking this and turning to people like the weathercasters, who aren't political, and they're welcomed into people's homes each and every night over dinner.
One of the events that takes place fairly frequently now down in Professor Maybach's neighborhood is the flooding around Norfolk, Virginia at high tide. Norfolk, Virginia is a place that's experiencing rising sea level in a more profound way than many others, because the ground is also subsiding at the same time that the sea is rising. But there are times at high tide when people can't park their cars at their houses because the streets are underwater. And those are well known and certainly publicized in the newspapers in Virginia. And that too is a teachable moment about rising sea level.
That connection isn't made often enough.
Yeah, there was a lot of media coverage of this issue in the late 2000s, 2006, 2007, around the time when Professor Pollack won his Nobel Prize, and media coverage of the issue dropped dramatically. For example, on nightly news, the rate of climate change stories in nightly news dropped 80% after that spike in 2007, 2008. And the same is true, or not quite as deep, but a very large decline in print coverage as well. But the coverage has started to rebound. I actually participated in a wonderful reporting exercise called the National Climate Assessment. We released our report in May of this year, and this is anecdotal as opposed to based on numbers. I've seen a really strong rebound in coverage of climate change recently, this summer, and I see a lot of stories that are consistent with what Professor Pollack is calling for, namely coverage of the local ramifications of climate change, not the global ramifications, which is very hard for people to stay interested in, or the future ramifications, which again is very hard for people to hold their attention to. But if you talk about the here and now, the ways in which climate change is influencing our neighborhood today, that's a story that's of interest to almost everyone.
Edward Maybach, professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and Henry Pollack, emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, who is sharing the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with former President Al Gore for his work on climate change. Really a pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.